Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people, and its host and founder is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she is a champion in the battle against ageism. In addition to Carol, today's program features our senior correspondent Steve Wiseman and our senior correspondent Kevin Casey. Steve Wiseman will be talking with Stephen Bearer about the dangers of exercise that is done without the proper amount of preparation and protection. And also we'll be joined, as I said, by Kevin Casey, who in addition to being our senior correspondent is also the executive editor of the trade publication Talkers Magazine, and he'll be talking a bit about what's going on behind the scenes in talk media. All right, let's kick off the program now with Carol Marks, front and center, a two-part conversation, part one, the beginning of the show, part two later in the program, with Mark Whitaker. He's the former managing editor of CNN, Washington bureau chief for NBC News. He's also a reporter and editor at Newsweek. He's going to talk to Carol about his latest book, Cosby, His Life and Times, published by Simon & Schuster.
Mark, you said there were two primary reasons you wanted to write about Bill Cosby. One was personal. The other was the appeal his life story had on your basic journalistic instincts. So can you tell us about those two things?
Sure. Well, like Bill Cosby, I started out as a child, 9 years old specifically, when I got my first Bill Cosby album. Back in the 60s, Wonderfulness. It was sort of a sad time in my childhood. My parents had divorced. I came from an interracial family. My father was black. My mother is white. My dad had sort of dropped out of our lives after their divorce. And we were living in a place in Massachusetts where there were no other people of color. And so all of a sudden, my mother brings home this this comedy album with this handsome young black man on the cover telling these hilarious stories about having his tonsils out and smearing Jell-O on the kitchen floor to keep the chicken heart monster away. So, you know, it brought laughter into my life. It gave me, you know, someone, a black male figure to identify with. And then, of course, later, like, you know, millions of Americans, I loved The Cosby Show, but it also came along in the 80s. At a time when I was starting a family. And so for my wife and me, it was, you know, a very funny show, but also kind of a model of what we hoped our home might be like someday. So those were sort of the personal reasons. But beyond that, you know, journalistically, I was interested not just in the various ways in which Bill Cosby has been a pioneer in comedy albums, in first African-American star of primetime television, children's television, commercials, and, of course, The Cosby Show, but also, I think, you know, the impact he's had as a cultural and even historical figure. Those were my journalistic reasons.
Now, since we are all largely formed by our early experiences, let's talk a little bit about Bill Cosby. He grew up in Philadelphia, didn't have a lot of supervision, and despite being tested as having the highest IQ in the fifth grade, what were the things he was into? Because, in fact, it was anything but studying.
That's right. You know, he was a bright student, but you know, didn't do his homework. And he had a difficult relationship with his father, who was a drinker, who essentially abandoned the family to join the Navy when he was young. His mother, who was terrific and, you know, cared a lot about education and read to him and so forth, worked as a maid. I had to work these very long hours, 12, 15 hours a day. And so she wasn't around. So there was really very little supervision. And, you know, he spent, rather than spending his time studying, he was an athlete. You know, he spent a lot of time just playing sports. He was very into jazz music at a young age. So he would stay up in his room practicing the drums. But mostly he was just hanging out with his friends and being sort of the class clown. And as a result, he flunked the 10th grade twice, then transferred to another high school and dropped out, and joined the Navy like his father without a high school diploma. And it was really only in the Navy that he started to develop real sort of habits of discipline and a plan for his life, and what he decided he wanted to do was to become a junior high school phys ed teacher. And despite just having a GED and a combined SAT score of 500, he managed to talk the track coach at Temple University into giving him a track scholarship.
Wow,
and
that's a good talker.
That's how he finally went to college, and it's while he was in college that his stand-up career started.
And when he left college to work on his comedy career, that really broke his mother's heart because, you know, she said she had worked as a maid to support the family, but she herself had dreamed of becoming a teacher, so that was trying for her at the time. And then you went on to say it in the book, something that I hadn't realized, that the years that Cosby spent in Greenwich Village developing his skills as a comedian were really the most surprising and interesting. And, you know, how in the world did he come up with that eye-opening idea of having a comedy that had universal themes and putting in his own personal stories? Because that really wasn't being done at the time.
That's right. Well, you know, it was while he was at Temple University in Philadelphia that he started, you know, trying his hand at stand-up. First, actually, just entertaining. He was working as a bartender and just entertaining the patrons. And then he convinced the manager, who had a little nightclub next door, to allow him to, you know, sort of in between the musical acts, to stand up and do some comedy. And then somebody who saw him there suggested a couple, an English couple, that he go to Greenwich Village over the summer, during his summer break, to a place called the Gaslight Cafe and perform there. So he arrives there in the summer of 1962. And, you know, he really doesn't have an act yet. He's trying out different things. And he's actually, at that time, doing a lot of humor that sort of was modeled after Dick Gregory, who was sort of the hot black comic of the time. So, you know, with, you know, sort of racial jokes and so forth. But the New York Times did a feature story about this, you know, young college student performing in the Village, in which it talked about all of this race humor. And when Cosby saw that story in print, he decided that he didn't want to be another Dick Gregory. Like the jazz musicians who he admired, he wanted to develop his own original voice. And before he left Temple for that summer, he had been in a restaurant and seen a guy just telling stories and keeping a whole table of people in stitches just with his long kind of funny stories. And it had stuck in his mind, and he decided at that point that that's the kind of comedy he wanted to do. He didn't want to tell jokes. He wanted to tell stories, but figure out a way to make them funny.
And he also decided that he was going to keep his material clean.
Exactly. It's really unusual because, I mean, you remember, this is the era of Lenny Bruce and so forth. But, you know, Cosby always thought that for a lot of comics, blue humor was a crutch. And it was an easy way to get people to laugh, and that he would have a much better sense of whether his comedy was working if he kept it clean.
Now, Bill Cosby did so many extraordinary things, and, you know, I had forgotten that he was the first African-American to co-star in a television show, I Spy, although I've watched it. I enjoyed it so much in the 60s. But I never realized that he has had acting challenges in doing the show, and also that his co-star, Robert Culp, was really an unsung hero because he made sure that both he, the white, you know, secret agent, and Cosby, the black secret agent, really operated as equals. And I think if he hadn't really gone out of his way, that might not have happened.
That's absolutely right. When Cosby was cast in that show by Sheldon Leonard, the producer, he had no acting experience. And in fact, he was so bad in the pilot episode that the executives at NBC, the network, wanted to replace him. But Sheldon Leonard stood up for him, and so did Robert Culp, who was his co-star. And Culp decided that in addition to using his clout as the star of the show to give Cosby a bigger role, he was also going to write several episodes that would showcase Cosby's character and even allow him to have a romantic interest, which, of course, the network had no interest in, you know, an African-American star, you know, being seen to have a love life on television. And it was really a result of those scripts and also the rapport that the two of them developed on camera that show became a hit. And they had a term for it, which was the impact that they wanted to have, which was that their racial statement would be a non-statement. Simply by showing these two people equals, friends of different races, that in and of itself would be revolutionary. And I talk in the book not just about their relationship, but also all the doors that show opened up, because 3 years later, after, you know, Cosby becomes the first African-American star of a primetime TV, there are featured African-American actors in a dozen shows. You have Julia with Diane Carroll. You have Mod Squad with Clarence Williams. Many of those actors had actually guest starred on I Spy during its 3-year run. So that show had a tremendous impact that continued even beyond the 3 years that it ran. And also, the other thing that people forget is that Cosby won an Emmy every single year, 3 consecutive years, for his role in that show.
That's Mark Whitaker in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled Cosby, His Life and Times, published by Simon & Schuster. You can find out more at markwhitaker.com, and you can find out even more by sticking around later in the program. This hour, we'll hear part 2 of the conversation between Carol Marks and Mark Whitaker. I'm Michael Harrison. Stick around. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in a moment.
There are a ton of social networking websites, but one stands apart for a very special reason. This one saves lives. It's MatchingDonors.com. MatchingDonors.com links organ donors with people in need of kidney and other transplants. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. If you've ever considered becoming a living organ donor, or if you're someone in need of an organ transplant, visit MatchingDonors.com, home of the greatest gift of all, the gift of life, MatchingDonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and coming up later in this hour, we'll hear part 2 of the Mark Whitaker conversation with Carol Marks, talking about Cosby, his life and times. But right now, our senior correspondent Stephen Wiseman is here to talk with Dr. Stephen Bearer. He's director of the Neuroscience Institute and Philadelphia Magazine's Top Doc, and he'll discuss his new book titled Exercise Will Hurt You, Concussion, Traumatic Brain Injury, and How the Dangers of Sports and Exercise Can Affect Your Health. It's published by Seven Stories Press.
We know that exercise is good for us, so isn't more better?
Not when you're not careful. And even if you are extremely careful, you'll probably hurt yourself. I don't know how much you exercise or how many sports you've played over the years, but I don't really know anyone who exercises or plays sports who hasn't hurt themselves in one way or the other.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is good for you, and nowhere do I ever say it's not good for you, but I do say it can hurt you.
Yeah, and exercise is part of my daily routine, and I have played a lot of sports over the years, and I have injured myself many times over the years and more as I age, which leads me to, you certainly agree that exercise is an important part of people's health, isn't that correct?
It is.
Are there any specific sports or exercises, particularly as we get older, that we should maybe avoid?
Well, I talk about that a fair amount in the book, and I am a member of the baby boomers, and I address a lot of my comments to that generation because it's really the first generation that has incorporated exercise into their lifestyle. And we overdo it. So things to stay away from specifically, I talk a lot about contact sports and the dangers of concussion. I'm a neurosurgeon. I take care of a lot of head-injured patients, and I spend a lot of time on concussions and mild traumatic brain injury and how it's maybe not really that mild. That, of course, I think really speaks more to the younger generations. To
sure.
The older generations, it's really just a matter of moderation and knowing what you're getting into. In the introduction of my book, I talk about it as being informed consent for the exerciser. Because
yeah,
it's something no one ever tells you about. They
yeah.
buy it as a piece of a grim. They don't say how this can hurt you. They only say how it can help you.
You know, it's a good point, and something I think you refer to a term, the sports industrial complex,
yes.
Where we, you know, Eisenhower had coined the term the military industrial complex. Tell us about the sports industrial complex.
Sports is big business. Exercise is big business. It's billions, hundreds of billions a year if you include all the professional sports and the value of the NFL and the Major League Baseball and those sorts of levels of play. And there's a lot of money to be protected, so there are a lot of issues about how much information is out there about how this can harm you. We certainly have seen this with the NFL players' lawsuit against the NFL concerning their maybe hiding some of the significant negative effects of concussions from the players before this became a well-known and highly publicized issue. And there's a lot of chicanery out there. I talk a lot about the things that are out there that are sold as being very salutary for our health and with no data to support it, no information or facts to say, yes, what we're telling you is good for you actually is.
You know,
there's a lot of money to be made in sports and exercise.
One of the things about the book that I enjoyed very much, there's a lot of information. You are a real doctor. So all too often I talk to PhDs who want to be called doctor, but you're a real doctor. And yet
I'm not getting into that conversation.
You don't have to. It's very, very readable. And so you don't have to be, you don't have to have a PhD to understand and get something from it. But what about, and I'm a baby boomer like you, what about something that we are told is always going to be great for us, yoga or Pilates? Can you even overdo those things?
You certainly can, and I have a section in the book about yoga. And in many of the discussions in the book, I talk about some of the more unusual and more dangerous types of problems. I don't dwell on the sprains and the strains. I talk about that, but every sport has that as part of it.
Oh, yeah.
For yoga, I talk more about neurologic consequences of doing certain kinds of poses that can cause damage to the blood vessels that go to the brain and can actually cause a stroke. I have an example, several examples in the book of patients who have done very unusual stressful poses involving the neck with significant angulation of the neck that can actually damage the blood vessels that go to the brain and cause a stroke.
Very scary stuff. How do you know when you're overdoing? Is there a way of knowing when you're overdoing it before it's too late?
Well, I talk a lot about the implications of pain. What does pain really mean? And you know, what does it mean to us from a protector perspective and from an evolutionary perspective, and how the whole no pain, no gain philosophy can actually be injurious if it's taken to an extreme. The other aspect is the fact that many people who are very serious exercisers or sports folks who do this professionally and ignore certain things because they assume that it's just part of the sport or part of the exercise and they have to put up with it. And so they ignore it and don't seek attention, and then what they're actually doing is adding insult to injury, and it just gets worse. And so recognizing when something is wrong is key, and dealing with it appropriately.
Isn't that another thing where people too often, I mean, we see it with professional athletes, but actually I was guilty of this myself, people returning to exercise too soon after injuring themselves. Is that a real problem?
It is, and it's part of that equation is also people who hide injuries because they don't want to be taken out of the game.
Yeah.
Student athletes who have scholarships riding on their performance, people who think they can become professional, and if they take too much time away due to injuries, may affect their professional possibilities. So yeah, not only going back too soon because they want to get back in the game, but not even taking themselves out of the game because they hide their injuries.
Now, talking again to an audience of baby boomers, what kind of exercise should we be doing, and how much of it?
I'm not sure there's any one answer for that. There are any number of types of exercises which are good for you. And I think whatever you can do that you, first of all, enjoy doing, that you can do in a disciplined way and come back to it and I talk about the book in the book about how that's my problem because I just don't like exercising, and I tend to be a lazy person, so I start something and then I say I've had enough of this and I move on. So if you can get yourself into a routine that you enjoy and do it as aggressively as you want to do it, but also as aggressively as you can, remembering that at 60 you may not be able to do what you could do at 40. So there are there's some common sense issues. There are some tips in the book about what to look for and what to do, how to deal with things when they come up, and to pay attention to your body. Listen to your body. It will always lead you down the right path.
You know, it's interesting because I enjoyed the book very much, but, you know, ultimately it came down to, as you said, the good old advice about moderation in everything and listening to your body, and that pretty much seems like a good way to live, period.
It is, and I think that we probably hear that many times in our life, and maybe we don't pay much attention to it. But as we start doing things that harm ourselves, we have to listen a little more closely.
Yeah, I've decided in my baby boomer age, I'm giving up bullfighting. I think I'm going to leave that to the youngers.
That's one sport I didn't touch on in the book.
Well, that and skydiving. I don't want to do anything that you have to do perfect the first time, or you plummet to earth and die. So that's another one.
You want something where there is some middle ground where you can fail and not be killed.
Exactly. You know, one last question is, a lot of us, as we're aging, start to have issues with our knees.
Yes.
And are there types of exercises that would be less stressful? I assume swimming would be for us.
Certainly anything that takes gravity away from you, swimming, anything in the water does that, and that's a very good option. But, yeah, I think things that are very repetitive for any joint that isn't doing well will make that joint a little bit more difficult to function normally, and you'll get pain as a result.
Dr. Stephen Behrer in conversation with Steve Wiseman. His book is titled Exercise Will Hurt You, Concussion, Traumatic Brain Injury, and How the Dangers of Sports and Exercise Can Affect Your Health. It's published by Seven Stories Press. I'm Michael Harrison. We'll be joined by Talkers Magazine's Kevin Casey in just a moment when A Touch of Gray continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And at this time in the program, we're joined by our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey, who also, his day job, as they say, is as the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers, which is the trade publication of the talk radio business. And you can visit Talkers at talkers.com. Kevin, we've been following a number of stories. We have the ISIS crisis. We have Ebola. And certainly sports always permeates our minds and our conversations in America. And we have the NFL heating up, and we have baseball coming down the wire with the World Series, which, you know, is very interesting to the people in San Francisco and Kansas City. Seems to, you know, the ratings aren't that great. But where's it stand right now? Let's take the temperature of the American public as conversation is measured on news talk radio stations such as the one we're on now.
Well, the conversation about the midterm elections on Tuesday has completely ramped up over the last week and a half, and that is really the hot topic because there's the specter of a potential takeover of the Senate by the Republicans.
And that is, of course, something that the conservatives, who dominate, I would say at this point, news talk radio opinion on the part of the hosts, are they're promoting that. They're pushing for that.
Yeah.
And I understand that Obama himself has gone on radio. He's gone on some of the urban talk stations, which is a industry term for African-American targeted stations. And
How many shows has he done? He's done a bunch of them, hasn't
he? He's done somewhere in the neighborhood of 10, maybe even a dozen. He's hit a couple of the big syndicated shows that some of our listeners may have heard of. Ricky Smiley is syndicated. There's Joe Madison, who is heard on Sirius XM, which is obviously the satellite service. So he's hit a bunch of these that hit a large part of the country as opposed to local shows.
I see. Well, you know, he's head of the politician, and they try to get the most bang for their buck, especially when you have other things to do. I guess the President of the United States is a busy job in addition to going out there and trying to politic on the part of your party, especially when many of the people running for office don't want to be seen with you, which is part of the picture. But talk radio remains the platform for the passing parade, and it just never runs out of marching bands. Talkers.com is the place to go, folks, if you want an inside view of what's going on in the talk radio business. It's the place the pros go. Kevin Casey, the vice president and executive editor of Talkers, as well as our senior correspondent on this program, we thank you for participating. I'm Michael Harrison. Stick around. More coming up on A Touch of Gray in just a moment.
Did you know? An estimated 16 million Americans suffer from a chronic inflammatory facial condition called rosacea, and most of them don't know it. Often mistaken for acne, there are many signs and symptoms of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels. Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, swelling, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. Any one of these signs and symptoms can mean rosacea, and without medical help, it can become increasingly severe and wreak havoc on your personal and professional life. Rosacea typically appears any time after age 30. So if you experience any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist for diagnosis and treatment. Or for more information, visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And now it's time for part two of the conversation we kicked off at the beginning of the program between the host of the show, Carol Marks, and Mark Whitaker, former managing editor of CNN, Washington bureau chief for NBC News, was a reporter and editor at Newsweek, and he has a book titled Cosby, His Life and Times, published by Simon & Schuster. Here now is part two of the conversation between Mark Whitaker and Carol Marks.
Your book reminded me of something that I had really forgotten, and that was that Bill Cosby had had a number of failures after he did I Spy, because we always think of him as being so successful, but in a way it's good when you have failures because you learn from them. And he then went on to The Cosby Show, and I guess he originally didn't want to play a doctor married to a lawyer.
That's right. So, so the 70s, after all the success he had had in the 60s, the 70s were a little bit of a difficult period for Cosby. His manager put him into a production deal went south, and he came within $50,000 of going broke. His comedy albums weren't selling anymore. He had three TV shows that were flops. So he really, in the 70s, was earning his living just, you know, staying on the road, performing, performing in Las Vegas frequently, and also developing his career as an advertising pitchman. And when The Cosby Show comes along, what I argue is it was both his previous successes, but also his failures that prepared him for that opportunity. And he sort of put all of everything he had learned over the previous 20 years into that show. But it is funny, as you say, when he was first approached by Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner, the two young producers who oversaw that show, about returning to television on a sitcom, his initial idea was that his character should be a limousine driver and that his wife should be Hispanic and be either a carpenter or a plumber. And Carsey and Werner, who had had this idea for Cosby in a sitcom based on the stand-up routines that Cosby had been doing about his own family, had said, no, it's going to be much better and actually funnier and more interesting if this family is like your family, your real family, and the parents are highly educated, think of themselves as being intelligent, but still are tearing their hair out because of all the problems they're having with their children. And it was actually only after Cosby's wife, Camille, weighed in support of the producer's vision that Cosby relented and said, okay, we'll do that. And as a result, as we all know, Cliff and Claire Huxtable were a doctor and a lawyer.
And they're still being watched today because the episodes are just timeless. You know, I love to be able to correct things sometimes when they're printed. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about what the truth was really about when Bill Cosby gave a fiery speech in 2004 that he was criticized for, because he criticized African Americans for failing to embrace personal responsibility and not being better parents. But I had never really heard about the main part of his speech, and I found that just amazing, because he used a true example of a young kid getting shot in the head over stealing a pound cake to make his point. So can you kind of fill us in on all of this?
Yes, so this was a speech that he gave on the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. There was a big event in Washington, D.C., and there were many speakers, and Cosby was supposed to come on at the very end just to receive an award for his philanthropy for the tens of millions of dollars that he and his wife have given to historically black colleges and universities. But as he heard one speaker after another talk about all the progress that had been made in the 50 years since Brown v. Board, Cosby got more and more agitated, because in his view, that decision had opened the doors to integrated education to black America. And since then, although many African Americans have taken advantage of that, there are elements of the black community that, you know, now sort of, you know, think that trying to get an education is acting white, where, you know, in Cosby's view, you know, there's not enough attention paid, not just to education, but to raising children the right way, to dressing properly, to speaking properly. And anyway, so he hadn't planned it, but once he was so emotional by the time he got up on the stage, he just went into this, you know, 20-minute rant. Once news of this, of his speech got out, it ignited this huge debate and controversy within the black community. A lot of people agreed with him, said we should be talking about personal responsibility. Others thought he was blaming the victim and not taking account of institutional racism. But, you know, there are two things that I point out, and I cover both sides of the debate. But one is, you know, some of the people who criticized him said that he was an elitist. He was this rich entertainer who didn't understand the plight of these kids in the inner city. Well, the fact is, my view is that, you know, he was so passionate partly because he saw himself in them, that having grown up in a housing project in North Philadelphia, he thought it was only when he embraced the discipline of the Navy and, you know, decided that he was going to take his studies seriously and go to Temple University that his life turned around. So in a way, he was kind of, you know, talking about the things that had mattered in his life. The other thing, which, you know, I think not everybody knows, is that after having given that speech and then continuing to, you know, make some of the same points in other speeches, Cosby, you know, also has sort of backed that up by going in over the last 10 years over and over again into poor neighborhoods, in urban areas, in the rural South, to talk to young people about being better parents, to talk to kids about going into school, staying in school, you know, meeting with gang members. So, you know, whatever you think of his message, he hasn't just talked the talk, he's also walked the walk.
And you said that just beautifully. I understand that you wrote the book with Bill Cosby's cooperation, but the biography was your idea, and you were well into the process of writing it before you had several interviews with him. What were the most important feelings about him that you came away with?
Well, as you say, that's right. I mean, when I first approached him, he wasn't interested in working with me or cooperating, but eventually that changed. And I did get time with him. And also, you know, I also got to talk to people who've known him very well behind the scenes, you know, growing up before he became a star and behind the scenes of his shows. And, you know, a lot of what you'll read in the book comes from them. You know, I think that there are two things that I sort of, just in my personal dealings with Cosby, came away with. One is just a fascination with how his mind works, because, you know, those of us in the communication business are used to people who, you know, sort of think and talk in very kind of linear, analytical ways. He's not like that at all. You know, he's very associative. He talks in stories. You know, it's based on intuition and creativity and so forth. So, you know, interviewing him was actually a little bit of a challenge because, you know, he wouldn't just answer your questions. You know, you would say something and he would tell a story. So you had to sort of figure out how to pose questions that would elicit the stories that you needed. But the other thing that I think both, I got to go on the road with him and see him interact with people and see how hard he works and how early he shows up for his concerts and for airline flights and so forth. And also from the research I did, I was just struck by just how persistent and resilient he is. You know, and you talked earlier about his setbacks and failures. And you know, people think of Cosby, you know, and remember his successes, but he's had just as many professional failures. And, of course, he's had tremendous both personal fortune, but also tragedy in his life, most notably the murder of his only son. And I was just struck by the fact that through it all, he just keeps going. He keeps working. He never lets, you know, bad fortune get him down. He never lets good fortune, you know, he never gets too carried away by it. And, you know, just, I found that, you know, ultimately just very moving, that, you know, this guy who we think of so famous has had a lot of the problems in life that, in some cases, even worse than the rest of us have suffered. But yet, through it all, he's kept his head high and he's just, you know, kept at it.
And, you know, it's amazing because he is an example for all of us because he's 77 years young and you know, I was also impressed by the fact that when he's on the road, he doesn't travel with an entourage, which so many stars do. You know, he's so down to earth. It's just amazing. And I think he's going to continue to perform. Actually, now he's doing more than 60 days a year as long as he can.
Well, absolutely. I think, like a lot of comedians, I think he's really sort of addicted to that, and you can see why. I mean, you know, and, you know, he's now at a time when, you know, here's a guy who at one time was the biggest and highest paid star in America, and now he's still out there performing in big arenas and in you know, small cities and so forth, just, and all he needs to, you know, make a whole concert hall full of people laugh is a chair and a microphone.
Mark Whitaker, in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled Cosby, His Life and Times. More information, markwhitaker.com. I'm Michael Harrison. Steve Wiseman joins us to talk a little bit about President Obama's executive order. That's next when A Touch of Gray continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. It's time now for the final segment of this hour of our broadcast and a return to the broadcasting stage by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Steve Wiseman is an attorney and he is a prolific author. He's one of the nation's leading experts on scams and fraud. He's just written a book titled Identity Theft Alert, published by Prentice Hall. He's written The Truth About Avoiding Scams, also Prentice Hall, and he has a website that is titled scamicide.com. I suggest you give it a visit. It'll make you smarter, wiser, and safer. Here now, Steve joins us to talk about President Obama's executive order. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, President Obama just signed an executive order that's going to lead the way for greater protection for Americans from data breaches and identity theft. He also announced a number of companies, including Home Depot, Target, Walgreens, and Walmart are accelerating their move to the more secure chip and PIN credit cards used at their stores. Now, the regulations that would hold retailers financially responsible for credit card fraud don't go into effect until October 2015, which is why a lot of these companies have put off doing the switch over to this new technology. But these companies that I just mentioned are planning on completing the move to smart cards by January of 2015. Walmart's pretty much actually completed. Also starting in January, Citibank and FICO are joined together to make credit scores available free to Citibank credit card holders. Remember, FICO is the company that does do credit scores. And right now, although you have the right to a free credit report, you generally don't have a right to a free credit score. And that's an important thing for everybody to check out. Now, I mentioned Citibank, but Discover, Barclaycard, Pentagon, Credit Union, and First National Bank of Omaha already have programs like that, too. And it's hoped a lot of banks will follow this example. Under the president's order, the reporting of credit card fraud is going to be made quicker and easier over the next 2 years. And finally, the president announced that the Department of Justice and the FBI are working together to improve greater information sharing between hack companies and affected consumers, because this is something that has made a lot of problems for all of us, because many retailers have not been willing to share information with the government. Now, the president's actions are a good first step. They do indicate a greater willingness of business to work with government and in order to better protect consumer data. However, there's a lot to be done, and frankly, congressional action is definitely required to improve the laws necessary to protect us as consumers from data breaches and identity theft. Until then, really what we can do as consumers, monitor your credit report, monitor your credit card usage. Don't use a debit card for retail purchases. Only use it as an ATM card. Do these things. Get yourself a nice complex password, and you're going to do the best you can.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. And again, folks, scamaside.com, Steve's website, and Identity Theft Alert by Steve Wiseman, published by Prentice Hall, and The Truth About Avoiding Scams, books to get. Steve Wiseman, a regular feature of A Touch of Gray. Thank you to Kevin Casey. Thank you, of course, to Beverly Santinella, our producer, and Carol Marks, the host of the program. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.